You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Please be seated. All right, we're on the record. State of Arizona versus Daybell, CR 2021-001704. State's present, the defendant and her team are present. The jury is not present. Who's the defense, or who's the state calling this afternoon?
After we're finished with this witness, we have Jeff Moberg and then Cassandra Enclan.
Are you able to estimate yet when you think you're likely to conclude your case in chief?
I think likely Thursday.
All right. So we are moving at a fairly quick rate. Let's talk about these motions. One of them may be relevant this afternoon. The motion in limine regarding the questioning of police. Has the defendant have a chance to review that motion?
I did get a chance to review it, Your Honor.
Can you pull the microphone down?
I did get a chance to review it. I did not get an opportunity to discuss it with my advisory team. We were able to have like a 30-second discussion right before we came in. So I would like to have an opportunity to do that before I have to.
I think you said Did you say Mr. Moffitt's testifying this afternoon?
No.
Oh, you didn't.
Moberg.
Say. Moberg,
yeah,
sorry.
Sorry, no.
Can I see the witnesses? Witnesses.
So theoretically, she could, if we get to cross of Detective Cassandra Enclan, that could become potentially an issue there. I don't know. I only put.
Well, I guess here's the issue is, I don't know to what extent you might have intended on crossing police officers about why you weren't arrested that day, or why your brother wasn't arrested that day, or why it took however long for charges to be submitted, or those types of things. Were those things you were planning on questioning anyone about?
Not exactly in those terms.
In what terms, then?
Asking those specific questions. Those were not on my list. However, it will become apparent that we were not arrested that day, so I don't foresee it being a problem. I'm not trying to.
I think that the timing.
Go into detail on that.
The timing of what was happening, how the investigation unfolded as far as timing, who was charged, who wasn't charged, would not be relevant. And I think that's what the state's motion is toward, because I think one of the first witnesses in the case, there was a question about why you or your brother weren't arrested that day. Which again isn't relevant, because it gets, if you go down that path, you could foreseeably open a door into, there's a lot of reasons why the investigation probably took quite a while that the jury doesn't really need to know about, nor is it relevant for them to determine what did or didn't happen on that particular day that you've been charged with. I'm just kind of giving you a heads up that I don't think it's relevant. If you think it's relevant and we get to cross of this witness today, and you think you have a question regarding the timing or who was or wasn't arrested, ask if we can take a break, all right?
Okay, sure.
Then we have, well, let me ask the defendant this. You've subpoenaed Robert Bobby Vallow, apparently was sent that subpoena or served that subpoena for a date that's already passed. Is this, again, someone that you believe has relevant information to your case?
No, Your Honor, that was just an oversight. That was a mix-up of clerical error. So we apologize to him or his family or any distress that caused. That was mixed up with an exhibit. his name was mixed up with an exhibit. It's very difficult on the phone at the jail when they cut me off every 20 minutes, and sometimes the notifications that get to my paralegal and my investigator do not come through clearly.
All right. The court will find that that subpoena, first of all, wasn't effective in the way that it was served out of state on an out-of-state witness. It sounds like the defendant's withdrawing that subpoena. Can we say that?
Absolutely. You can crush it.
So that one's withdrawn. Are there other...
Your Honor, just... I know you filed the state's email. I did have attachments of that on there. If those are part of the record, can we seal that as well? Because obviously it still has Bobby Vallow's information.
I've only sealed your email, and I've sealed the actual two subpoenas that we discussed this morning.
Thank you.
Was there another, Mr. Boudreau was served with a subpoena for this case, is that correct?
That is my understanding, Your Honor.
All right.
Those subpoenas were sent out from OPDS. We turned them into OPDS before you struck that witness, Your Honor.
Okay, so that subpoena is effectively quashed, and as I said, that one would be filed under seal as well. Then we have... Let me just check the time here, 1:23. The motion in limine regarding the testimony of the video observed by Janice Cox and Summer Shiflett. Have you had a chance to review that and discuss it?
I haven't had a chance to discuss that with advisory counsel, and I would like the opportunity to do that, Your Honor.
All right, that's fine. I don't think that's imminent for today.
No.
And then I think we can also take up the state's third motion to preclude... later today or sometime tomorrow. Let's have the witness come back in. I think all our jurors are present, so we can start a few minutes early. Let me ask my staff. They reprogram those headsets. All right, so. All right, please be seated. The jury is present. You can continue with your direct examination.
Thank you. When we took our break for lunch, we had just admitted Exhibit 215, I believe. And inside this contained the beneficiary designation form that was filled out by Mr. Vallow. Oops, let me wait till we get our Elmo up. Correct, this is the form that we were discussing from the February 26th beneficiary change.
Yes, that's correct.
So we see that it's signed and notarized?
Correct.
And what this then shows is the primary beneficiary is now Ethel K. Woodcock?
Yes.
And then were there also contingent beneficiaries?
Yes, there were.
What are contingent beneficiaries?
Contingent beneficiaries are listed in the event the insured passes away and the primary beneficiary had predeceased the insured, meaning passing away before the insured, since the primary beneficiary was no longer living, it would then drop to the contingent beneficiaries to receive the death benefit.
Okay. So if Kay Woodcock had not been around when Charles passed, then it would have gone to Nicholas Charles Vallow and Zachary Chase Vallow.
That's correct.
When a primary beneficiary or a contingent beneficiary is removed from someone's life insurance policy, does Banner Life Insurance call that person up and let them know, hey, letting you know you're not the primary beneficiary anymore?
No.
Why not?
They're not the policy owner, so they would not be entitled to that information.
So again, the policy owner is the person who can do whatever they want with the policy.
Correct.
On July 15th of 2019, did Lori Ann Vallow call Banner Life Insurance to make a death claim?
Yes.
And was that call recorded?
Yes, it was.
And is that the audio that you listened to before we took our break for lunch?
Yes, it is.
Your Honor, if I may publish this. And again, that's just something that's the normal course of business that Banner Life records all of those people.
All of our calls are recorded, yes.
Are you, you have the white?
Claims Department, this is Robin. May I have the policy number?
Sure.
Is it a death claim?
Yes.
Okay, one moment, please. May I have the name of the insured?
L. Charles Vallow.
Who am I speaking with?
This is Lori Vallow.
And your relationship to the insured?
He's my husband.
Okay, one moment. Okay, ma'am, I'm just going to need to ask you a few questions so that I can open the claim, and then I can go over the claim procedure with you and answer any questions that you may have afterwards.
That would be great.
Okay, first of all, may I have your daytime phone number, please?
Sure, it's 8.
And what was the date of Mr. Vallow's passing?
July 11th.
And what was the cause of his passing?
Well, he was shot.
Okay.
So I don't know what, how I want to put that.
Okay. All right. I hate to ask, but is it, you can just say yes or no. Was it a homicide?
No, it was an accident.
An accident, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what state did he pass away in?
Arizona.
Okay. All right, just bear with me for one moment. I just need to pull up a few other things.
Okay.
Are you aware of who the primary beneficiary of the policy is?
It's me.
Bless you.
Okay, and may I have your, I'm sorry, one moment, my computer just went away for a second. Okay, and may I have your current mailing address?
Sure, it's 5585249.
Okay, ma'am. That is all the information I need to open the claim. What we will do now is review the policy in the file to confirm the beneficiary information and determine the claim requirements that we will need to settle this particular claim. Once we have completed our review, we will prepare a claim packet to send to the named beneficiary once that has been confirmed. And the claim packet can either be mailed or emailed or faxed. How would you like to receive a correspondence?
Email would be great.
Okay, and what is your email address?
It's Lori, L-O-R-I.
Okay. All right. So you should receive an email from our office within the next 3 to 5 business days or sooner. It will have the instructions listed. Once you receive the information, if you have any questions whatsoever, please don't hesitate to give our office a call. And then we can go from there. Okay. Is there anything I can help you with at this time?
That's it, I think.
Okay, ma'am. Well, I'm very sorry for your loss. You take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, so we hear in Exhibit 215, that's yourself speaking with Ms. Vallow?
Yes.
And we hear her, you ask her if she knew who the primary beneficiary was, correct?
Yes.
And who did she advise was the primary beneficiary?
Herself.
We also hear you ask about sort of the cause of death for Charles Vallow, correct?
Yes.
And you asked when there was a pause if it could be, well, after she told you he was shot, right?
Yes.
Did you need to know sort of, was it a suicide? Was it a homicide? Was it a...
Correct, yes.
And so did you follow up by asking her if it was a homicide?
Yes.
And she advised you it was an accident.
Correct.
You got a phone number from her, the 808-755-5452 number?
Yes.
And her email address, the LoriForStyle at iCloud account?
Yes.
And then you had verified with her that she wanted to receive any correspondence by email, correct?
Correct, yes.
And in fact, did you advise her that the named beneficiary would receive information via email then?
Correct.
Is it normal when you have someone call in to make a death claim to wait and look up things before you let them know?
Yes, that is our standard procedure.
Okay, so you aren't doing anything weird there. That's just what you guys have to do. So what does Banner Life do to verify that that person is, that Lori Vallow was the beneficiary?
We review everything on the policy file in the system, as well as any paper document that has come through, such as an ownership change, beneficiary change, anything of that nature during the entire life of the policy since it was issued, to confirm that information, to make sure that we are providing the information to the appropriate party.
Did you in this call know at some point that there was perhaps something incorrect about her being the beneficiary?
Not during the call.
Did you look up afterwards?
Yes.
Okay. When somebody calls in to notify that there's been a death and try to get the policy payout, what would normally be required? Do they just have to call in and then you send them a check if their name's on there?
No. We review each policy to determine the claim requirements for that specific claim. They can vary from claim to claim, depending on, you know, the situation with that particular policy. That is why we do prepare a claim packet specific for each claim that has been reported. We provide a packet of information with a cover letter that lists the claim requirements that are needed. And the two things that are always going to be required is our specific claim form that we provide for the beneficiary to complete, as well as a death certificate, which states both cause and manner of death.
Okay. So after Lori Vallow calls saying she's the primary beneficiary of that life insurance policy for her husband, Charles Vallow, did Banner Life Insurance actually determine that she was not the primary beneficiary?
That's correct.
So now that you know she's not the primary beneficiary, how did you notify her of that?
I believe there was a letter that was submitted to her via email as she requested correspondence to be delivered to her in that aspect.
So would the letter tell her who was the primary beneficiary?
No.
Would the letter have told her when that was changed?
No.
It just advised her, would have advised her that she was not the primary beneficiary. Would Banner Life ever tell anyone who the new beneficiary is?
No.
Why not?
We can't release that information. That's personal and private information.
And that's something that just the policy owner has the right to determine.
Correct.
So was an email sent to Lori Vallow on July 18th of 2019 to advise her that she was not the beneficiary?
Yes.
And did she call back to speak with you about her, about the issue?
Yes.
And was there sort of a back and forth of phone tag before you were able to finally speak with her?
Yes, I believe she left a voicemail for me as I was unavailable. I returned her call, and I believe I had to leave her a voicemail, and then she did call me back, and we were able to connect at that point.
Okay. Erin, if I can have my paralegal approach with Exhibit 280. And if you can listen to that and see if you recognize that as yourself and Ms. Vallow again from the July 18th of 2019 conversation. Maybe you can just let us know when you have heard and recognized that as the July 18th of 2019 call.
Yes, I do recognize the phone call.
Thank you. Your Honor, the state will move to admit Exhibit 280.
280?
280.
Any objection?
No objection, Your Honor.
280 is admitted.
And if we may publish that.
Claims Department, this is Robin. May I have the policy number?
Sure.
Okay, I do have that policy pulled up. Who am I speaking with?
This is Lori Vallow. I'm returning your call.
Yeah.
I missed you.
Okay, no problem. Let me just get all of this information up. Okay, so in your voicemail, you stated that you had something that stated you are the beneficiary of the policy.
Right, so I have the original policy where I was the beneficiary. The sole beneficiary, and then we changed the policy to where I was 80%, and we added two people, the Porches, who invested in our company for each 10%. And that's the last one I have. That's the last update that I have. So can you tell me when that was changed again? I mean, I know my husband is the agent on record, so he can change it. He's the owner.
Okay, I don't see anything regarding the second change that you said. I don't, and with those percentages, I don't see anything at all with you as 80% at any time.
Okay, so but maybe that's something he just told him he was going to do. That's just a handwritten copy I have that I found. So.
Okay, so well, I really can't give too much information, but I can tell you that the beneficiary was changed in March of this year.
Okay. Okay, I'm trying to figure out what he was doing since we have five kids and we've been married for 15 years.
I'm sorry.
So I know he owes a lot of people money, and I was worried if I got money, they'd be coming after me for money.
Right. No, I understand that.
But now I will be with none. So, but did he change it to one person or was it several people?
Unfortunately, I can't release that. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay. No, I know you can't tell. We're in the business. My husband is the agent. He's the agent.
Okay.
So.
Got it. Okay.
We deal with this business all the time, so I kind of know how it works, but I'm completely surprised.
Right.
We have our 7-year-old with autism that we adopted together, so I am surprised that he would do that without telling me.
I'm so sorry.
So, I mean, there's nothing you can do about that, even though it's community
No, this is a contract that we have with the insured, exactly. So he's able to make any changes, during the lifetime of the policy.
Well, can I check? I mean, I have a policy, a $2 million policy on me. And since he's the agent, would he have been able to change the beneficiary on my policy?
Not if he was the agent. He would have had to own the policy, but I can certainly check.
But if he would have signed my name, could he have done that? I wonder.
I would hope that wouldn't happen, but let me just pull up. Okay, let me just take a look and see what I can find on you.
It's under Lori Vallow. I would be under Lori M. Vallow. Because we have a $2 million policy on me, but I'm not even sure it's with Center Life.
I'm not showing that it's with us.
Might be Life of the Southwest. We work with several companies.
Right.
But I could call them and ask. I'm just asking the question, I could call them and ask them and make sure the beneficiary is who I say.
If you have a concern of that nature, I certainly would call and check on your own policies if you, have concern if something may have happened.
Well, and I would have to change it anyway because he was the beneficiary as far as
correct.
I know on my policy.
Right. So you would definitely want to update that at this point. And
what happens, if something happened to me, say, today, and it's under him and he's deceased, what happens to that policy?
Every contract's different, but more than likely, if there was not a contingent beneficiary named, it would go to your estate.
To their estate.
Yeah. Yeah. But if there's, if there's a contingent beneficiary named, then it would go to that person.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
Okay.
Well, thank you. I just needed that information.
Okay. No, not a problem. All right. You take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
So in this call, we hear yourself again with Ms. Vallow?
Yes.
And we hear her telling you that her husband left her with 5 kids to care for, right?
Yes.
And she told you that she understands how life insurance works, right?
Correct.
That she and her husband run this business about it, right?
Yes.
But then she asks you if an agent would be able to change who the beneficiary was?
Correct.
So she didn't really understand it.
I felt that she did not understand it fully.
And again, she told you she understood how this all worked, but then she asks you what would happen if she died at this point, who would get, her money since her husband had been her beneficiary?
Yes, she did.
So she... you had to advise her of the fact that if there were contingent beneficiaries, they would get it?
Yes.
Ultimately, did Banner Life Insurance have any insurance policy with Lori Vallow?
No, she did not hold any coverage under Banner Life.
When she was talking to you, at one point she asked you or said, there's nothing you can do about that, right?
Correct.
And there's nothing you can do to change that. That is something that the owner is able to do.
Correct. We could not make any changes.
Regardless of if you feel bad for someone.
Exactly.
Is it awkward for you when you have to talk to someone who thinks that they were the beneficiary and learns they're not?
It can be, yes.
Was that your last interaction with Lori Vallow?
To my recollection, yes.
Who did Banner Life Insurance Company ultimately pay the $1 million policy to?
to Mr. Vallow's sister, Kay Woodcock.
And before the insurance company, before Banner Life would pay that out to Kay Woodcock, did you actually have to call and verify with the police that she was not involved in the homicide or the murder of Charles Vallow?
Yes, that's correct.
I have no other questions for this witness.
Cross.
No questions, Your Honor.
Excuse me?
No questions.
All right. Are there any questions for this witness from any member of the jury? I don't see any. You can step down. Thank you. State can call its next witness.
Thank you.
All right, sir, come on right up here, in right in front here, and be sworn in.
Please spell your name for the record.
Jeff, J-E-F-F, over, M-O-V-E-R-G.
Thank you. Please raise your right hand. You do solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
All right, you're going to have a seat. Just walk around the court reporter. Have a seat to my left.
Thank you. Would you please introduce yourself to the jury?
Sure. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jeff Moberg. I'm a forensic scientist with the Arizona Department of Public Safety in the Firearms and Toolmark Unit.
How long have you worked there?
I've been with DPS since February of 2013. I've been assigned to the Firearms Unit since October 1st of 2018.
Can you tell us about your education and training to work in the area of firearms identification?
Sure. Part of the hiring standards for the DPS Crime Lab is I do have a bachelor's degree in chemistry from Arizona State University. My specialized firearms training is I attended the National Firearms Examiner Academy hosted by the ATF in Laurel, Maryland. The academy consists of four phases. It's approximately a year long, with phase one being research and history of and all of the techniques that go into it. Phase two is a full on-site 17-week training experience in Maryland, practicing exactly what it is that we do. Then we go into practical examinations, meaning I'm doing competency tests and proficiency tests throughout the summer and preparing a research project, which in phase four I will present and conduct mock trials.
Do you have ongoing training as well?
We do. Every year we're offered the opportunity to attend SHOT Show, which is the firearms industry trade show in Las Vegas every year. There's also the Association of Firearms and Toolmark Examiners meeting once a year, which is our annual training. It is nothing but peers within my discipline doing seminars and presenting on findings for various cases and various new technologies coming out.
And in DPS itself, is there any type of QAS or means to ensure that all of the firearms examiners are continuing to perform appropriately?
Absolutely. After the training, we are all given a competency test. We have to demonstrate our ability to do the job. So it's a very complex test consisting of all of the disciplines that we do, tool marks, firearms, serial number restoration, various other aspects of my job. But then every year we're given a proficiency test from an outside source, which was, so we're testing our continued or demonstrating our continued competency within the field.
So I want to start by asking you just some generic questions about how a semi-automatic handgun works.
So a semi-automatic gun, meaning a semi-automatic means that it is designed to fire one round with a single pull of the trigger, but it's also meant to cycle the firearm. And what I mean by cycle is the process of loading a firearm means introducing a magazine, particularly in a semi-automatic, which contains a number of cartridges. Cycling it means pulling the slide back and allowing it to go forward. When that happens, it strips off one of the cartridges from the magazine and loads it into chamber. So we call that chambering. At that point, it is ready to fire. When the trigger is pulled, the firing pin is released on a striker type system. It's a spring-loaded firing pin or a hammer type system where it's a weighted hammer that goes in and strikes a firing pin to hit this back of this cartridge to ignite the round. It then begins, the pressure builds up within that cartridge, expels the bullet down the barrel, but that same amount of pressure is also working to push it back. So it pushes that slide rearward, so it starts to move it back, unlocks the barrel, lets it go all the way back, and then comes forward and loads the next one.
So I'm going to put up first, I have Exhibit 76 here. Is this a semi-automatic handgun?
Yes, it is.
And then I'm going to put 85 in here. Is that what a live round looks like?
A live round, or we call it a cartridge. It's just a single unit of ammunition, consists of the cartridge case, primer, powder, and projectile.
So when a handgun is used and the trigger is pulled, we have a projectile that goes out to the barrel of the gun. What happens to the rest of that cartridge or live round?
So the rectangular portion on top, the black portion of the slide that's on top, that whole thing moves. So it will actually, when the cartridge is fired, the pressure of that cartridge will force that rearward, and it opens up that chamber so that the expelled cartridge can be ejected, the cartridge case will be ejected, and the new one can be loaded in via the magazine. The very bottom here where the kind of the hand is grabbing at the bottom is where the magazine is inserted.
So, put Exhibit 77. Is this where you're talking about where the cartridge is going to eject from?
That is actually showing the side of the barrel that which houses the chamber, but that section opens up and that is where the ejection takes place.
So you had talked about this in some of the different jobs that you do as a firearms analyst. When a person fires a semi-automatic handgun, are there any sort of identifying tool marks that might be left on the projectile or the bullet?
Absolutely. All of that pressure that builds up and is pushing the cartridge case back, it is resting against what we call the breech face. The breech face has a hole in it where the firing pin comes through and it strikes the primer. The primer is just that little button in the center of the cartridge. It's actually a very volatile compound that ignites the powder charge instantly. So all of that pressure builds up and presses against that breech face. This being a semi-automatic, as it cycles back, the barrel has to unlock. So it moves slightly back, but then as it unlocks, it drops down. And as it drops down, that cartridge case is scratching up against the surface of that breech face, imparting all kinds of marks that we use for comparison purposes.
When the projectile itself is fired out the barrel. Are there any tool marks left on that?
Yes. So when the bullet is being pushed out of the barrel, through the barrel, all of that pressure is pushing it through. A barrel is rifled. Now, rifling is a pattern of lands and grooves that are in a rotational pattern that impart the spin on there. All of that pressure causes the back end of that projectile to expand and to fill that void. So as it's going through, it's dragging along the inside of the barrel, picking up any of the imperfections from the manufacturing process that are there, similar to a fingerprint. So when it comes out, we're able to look around there and you can see the pattern of the rifling all the way around the bullet and the individual striations or scratches on the surface coming from the inside of the barrel.
So if you are provided with a gun casings and projectiles, are you able to determine in any way if those casings or projectiles were fired from a specific gun?
Yes, and we do that by doing what we call a comparison. So we go ahead and we take that fired evidence and we're going to look at it. We want to verify that there's markings on there that we can use for comparisons. Then I'm going to test fire this firearm. I'm going to collect those test fired cartridge cases and projectiles if need be, and I'm going to do a comparison side by side on my comparison microscope. It's just a high powered microscope that allows me to see two things simultaneously side by side at the same magnification. So I'm going to have them side by side and try to line up those scratches and marks that are left on there from the machining process to the next.
So when we're talking about a barrel, you said there's like lands and grooves in there. Is that alone enough for you to identify if a projectile was fired from a specific gun, or are you looking for more specific, unique characteristics from each gun?
So each one, we start with what we call class characteristics. The class characteristics are those that are pre-designed before manufacture, such as what caliber is it? Is it a 9mm, is it a 45, 40, whatever it may be. Then we're going to look at how many lands and grooves are there. If there is, maybe there's five, maybe there's six, maybe there's eight. All of that we use as an initial screening. Can this come from this gun? Say I have a gun that's a 9mm and I have a 45 bullet. That's not possible. So it's an automatic rule out. But those imperfections from the manufacturing process are what we use, and how the scratches translate into there are very unique to those barrels.
So you said you test fire the weapon. Why do you do that? What are you using that for?
Well, when a case like that comes in, whenever we receive a weapon, we first and foremost, we want to verify, number one, that it's safe and unloaded. Number two, that it's actually operational as a weapon. So we're verifying that it can fire and it works as designed. But then I'm also using that time, I document the condition of it as I received it. I document any of the features that are on there, such as in this particular case up here, we have a brown and black gun. That's one of the notes that I would have on there.
When you are doing this comparison and looking for these unique characteristics that you may see from the tools or the actual combustion of this, are there different levels of interpretation or conclusions that you're able to reach during this comparison process?
Yes, when we're doing a comparison, we're first and foremost looking for marks that recreate. So the different levels of opinion that I can form at the end is I can identify. I can say this piece of fired evidence was fired from this gun. I could say this piece of evidence was not fired from this piece of gun, or this particular gun, excuse me. Or if there's just none of those marks that are reproducing or an insufficient amount of marks for us to actually compare, we can actually go out inconclusive, meaning I'm not sure whether it was or not.
So I'm going to have my paralegal go up to you with a few items here. It is exhibits 235, 38, 40, 239, and 246. going to let you sort of keep those, and I'm going to start with 246, the handgun. Okay. Were you provided with that gun as part of a request to determine if you could, well, were you provided with that gun?
I was. When we receive evidence such as a firearm, we actually initial date and put the identifying information to the case on the firearm. Right here, just underneath the slide on the frame of this firearm is the DR number, our department record number, the item number. So the combination of that DR number and the item number is our unique identifier to track that piece of evidence, and then my initials and date.
Okay. Were you provided with a couple of casings, 238 and 240?
Yes, I was. And again, when I received these, when we receive evidence such as this fired casing here, which is 240, we initial and date the day we receive it. So it's here. There's my initials and date from when I resealed it. It's currently hiding up. It's actually right up here at the top where I initial and dated it from when I received it.
Okay. And were you also provided with a projectile, if you can look at 235 and 239? And I believe you only had one of those.
That's correct. There's the one bullet I received right underneath our unique tracking. We barcode everything. It's got our department record number, item number. I initial and dated it as I received.
And which number was that?
This is item 239.
Thank you. What were you asked to do with these items?
This particular case, I was asked to compare the cartridge cases and the bullet back to the firearm.
And that's the firearm that we see here in Exhibit 77, what we see as 246.
Yes, it is.
All right. So starting with this, what can you tell us about the gun itself? What is the caliber? What is the brand of that?
The firearm is a Springfield Armory XDM 45 caliber semi-automatic pistol.
And so when we talk about 45 caliber, what does that mean?
45 refers to just the size of the bore. In this particular case, it's a 45 auto caliber, so or 45 ACP, common to most 45s made today. But that's actually the measurement of the bore.
Were you able to, when you looked at the, you told us you often look to see just initially, do these all match together? When you looked at the caliber of those casings that you were given, did they match with the 45 caliber?
The two cartridge cases I received were Fiocchi brand 45 auto caliber cartridge casings.
Okay. Now, what about the projectile, the bullet that you're given? Is there a way for you to determine if that is consistent with a 45 caliber being fired from a 45 caliber handgun?
Yes. So when we receive a bullet like this, I'm going to go ahead and measure the diameter across the fired bullet to achieve that, and it measured, I don't know the exact number, but it's approximately 0.45 inches.
Okay. Now, when you first were handed the gun, you said you'd make some notes about that. Did you note anything about it as to whether or not the gun appeared to have been previously fired at some point?
The only notes that we take is we do look down the barrel of the gun. When what I'm looking for is I'm mainly safety purposes. I want to make sure there's no obstruction, because if I fire it and there's an obstruction, could be catastrophic failure of the firearm. But I'm also looking at and documenting the rifling. And when we look down a barrel, we can see, I would notate that it's slightly fouled barrel or whatnot, meaning that there's powder particles and or traces of bullets going through the firearm.
So that would mean it was consistent with having been fired, at least.
Correct.
So you talked about test firing. Did you test fire this gun?
I did. I test fired this particular firearm into a water tank. I used the water tank because we wanted to collect projectiles for comparison purposes, and the water tank allows us to do that without damaging the bullets.
What kind of ammunition do you use? How do you determine that?
So first and foremost, we would like to use like ammunition. So this was Fiocchi brand ammunition. We hopefully would have some of that in our reference collection. However, I did not, so I would grab the next closest type of ammunition, I believe it was Winchester that I used in this particular case, that has the same exact type of primer, the same exact type of casing, and the same exact type of projectile.
When you talk about the same exact type, are you talking about like the metals, or what are you talking about?
For instance, the bullet in this case is a copper jacketed round nose full metal jacket. So I would look to test fire a copper jacketed full round nose bullet.
Okay. So when you test fired this gun, did you know anything with regards to the functionality of it?
I noted that it functioned as designed. I did test fire this by hand chambering. I didn't try a magazine in there because one wasn't submitted with it. But it operated with no problems.
Okay. How many times did you test fire it?
We collect a minimum of three in this particular case. I only did fire it three times. That's all that I needed.
And so you're each time you're having to put a bullet in there and pull the trigger each time?
That's correct.
If you'd had a magazine, would you still have had to pull the trigger each time to fire it?
Yes, it operates still semi-automatic, so the trigger would have to be pulled each time to fire a cartridge case. I just wouldn't have to reload one into the chamber each time.
Okay. So once you created these test fire, let's start with cartridges, did you attempt to compare those to the ones you were provided, Exhibits 238 and 240?
So one of the first things I'm going to do is I'm going to collect my test fires, and I'm going to compare them to each other. And why I'm doing that is I want to make sure that there's marks on there that reproduce over our test fires. If there's no marks reproducing, how would I be able to compare it to the evidence? From there, once I determine that it's a sufficient, and I do photo document all of my comparisons, once I figure it's sufficient for an identification there, I'll go ahead and do a comparison to the unknown evidence and make my opinion based on that comparison.
So the test fires that you have, you look to make sure that those are creating each time the same, both class characteristics and individual characteristics.
Correct, yes.
And the class being sort of the generic ones that every type of Springfield might create?
Correct, yes.
And these individual ones are characteristics that are specific and unique to this weapon?
Correct. They're from use, abuse, cleaning, anything like that, and the individual manufacturing of each component.
When you compared those two cartridge casings, 238 and 240, to the test fires that you created from Exhibit 246, the handgun, were you able to reach any conclusions?
I was.
And what was your conclusion?
I was able to determine, I identified those cartridge cases as having been fired in that on that particular firearm based on my comparison of the test fires to that evidence.
All right. So the two cartridge casings, 238 and 240, were fired from the handgun you have up there, 246.
Correct.
You also, when you test fired the gun, did you collect the projectiles, the bullets?
I did. I collected three bullets from our water tank for comparison purposes.
Did you go through the same process of looking at those three to see if they matched up?
I did, yes.
And did they?
They absolutely did, yes.
So again, they had sufficient class characteristics and individual characteristics for you to then proceed to try to identify them or compare them to the unknown bullet.
That's correct.
When you compared Exhibit 239, the projectile that was recovered, to the projectiles that you created when you test fired, were you able to reach any conclusions with regards to this weapon?
I was. Like the cartridge cases, I identified the projectile as having been fired from that particular firearm.
So the bullet that you were given, you've identified as having been fired from this Springfield semi-automatic 45 caliber handgun.
That's correct.
Did that end your work in this case?
That ended my analysis from this case. From then, I go ahead and I take all of my notes. The entire process, I'm photo documenting. So when I open this up and I was documenting the condition as it's receiving, I'm also taking photos. When I'm doing the comparison, I'm also taking photos of the evidence side by side and any kind of areas of interest that I'm looking at. So from there, I'm going to go ahead and document my opinion. and my results on our worksheets. I'm also going to print out all of my photos. I am then going to take all of that evidence, and I'm going to hand it to another trained examiner. That other trained examiner, without looking at my results, is going to take all of that evidence and do a comparison himself. And then he'll form his own opinion and then verify that it matches or is similar to my results.
And was that done here?
Yes, it was.
Did that alter in any way your opinion?
Not at all. He was in agreement of my results.
When you talk about the photos, so in your report, you're actually showing all of those characteristics that we've talked about to, so anyone else could later look at them and see how you reached your conclusion.
The photo documentation is just a snapshot of one portion of the comparison, but yes, a trained examiner should be able to look at them and understand what exactly I was looking at.
Okay, so ultimately your conclusion was both those cartridge casings and that projectile that you were provided was fired from the gun you were provided.
That's correct.
Thank you. I have no other questions.
Cross-examination.
I just have a couple questions, Your Honor. Mr. Moberg, when did you receive the request to test this firearm?
It was early March of this year.
So March 2025?
Yes.
Okay. And then how long after you received the request did you test the firearm?
I was notified that the request was coming in a couple of days. I received the evidence on a Wednesday, which my week wraps up on Thursday, and I did all of the work on that the following Monday, and the report was put out by Tuesday morning.
Okay, do you know what the date that Tuesday report was put out by?
I don't know the exact date. If you'd like, I can refer to my notes and give you that exact date.
Sure, that'd be great.
Is that okay?
Go ahead.
Is that okay?
So the report was authored on March 4th of 2025. The evidence was received in our property and evidence unit on 2/26 of 25, in which I also received them on that 2/26 of 25 and returned them to our evidence room on the 4th of March.
Okay, thank you. And who requested you to do this test on this firearm? Where did your request come from?
This particular request was made from a detective who reached out to me via email explaining could I assist him with a rush. I passed it through my supervisor who allowed me to contact the detective and have the evidence submitted. And then it was assigned to me because the request was sent directly to me.
Do you know what detective that was?
Detective Duncan.
And then who did you send your report to?
Once I'm finished with my analysis, my report is then reviewed by another examiner and then a supervisor to make sure that it's all technically correct, and then admin, and then they're electronically released to Detective Duncan.
Okay. And then you said you had done some photo documenting. Were those photos attached to this report?
They were attached to all of my case notes, yes.
Okay. So there's a report, case notes, and then the photo documentaries?
It's all part of, yeah, the notes and the photo documentation is all one.
And how long do you think that report was total?
Oh, it's roughly 13 pages total, 13, 14 pages with the actual report.
Okay. Thank you. So you fired the firearm three times, is that correct?
That's correct.
In your testing?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. And then did you point it all in the same direction when you fired?
When I did my test firing, I was firing into a water tank. The water tank has a, it's approximately 10-inch thick stainless steel tube with a rest inside of it that I fire it into, so it stays in one place and fires at a specific angle into the water so that I'm not striking anything or being unsafe in any way.
And what's your distance at that point?
Approximately a foot.
Oh, just a foot away into the water tank?
Into the water, yeah.
Okay. And then did all of the casings go into the exact same place, like close to the same place?
So around the inlet tube for where that we shoot into, we have a big net that catches the cartridge cases.
So you can't really tell where they land then, I guess, because the net catches them? Is that what you're saying?
It's land as far as they kind of shoot out of the gun and then get caught by the net.
Okay. So they don't land on the ground and roll to the close to each other. Okay. But you kind of got a feel for this gun because you shot it, right?
I did.
So if you were to shoot the gun straight and then move 40 degrees to the right and shoot it again, do you think that the casings would end up in the same area?
Objection as to speculation without foundation of...
He shot the gun, Your Honor. I was asking his opinion.
Hold on. He can answer, first of all, if he understands the question.
If I may clarify?
Sure.
So you're asking if I point a weapon, say this way, and then turn this way?
Correct.
Okay. I can't answer that.
Go ahead.
I would expect the cartridge case to be slightly different from the very first one, but not much, depending on what interacts with it in its flight path. If did it bounce off of something? What's the floor type? What is, or whatever it hits first? I couldn't say without knowing any of that.
Okay. So would it be safe to say that the casings would end up in the same place if you didn't move and you fired two shots? They should end up close to the same location.
Again, it really depends on what is around, because typically when a semi-automatic firearm is fired, the slide comes back and the cartridge case ejects up and to the right. So if you moved slightly, you're changing that angle slightly. So it could be slightly different. It could be in the same location depending on how they bounce and roll.
Okay. So if you fired the gun and the casing ricocheted off the wall, but then you moved the gun and fired it again somewhere else, it could miss the ricocheting of the wall altogether, right?
Again, without knowing the scene, I couldn't say.
Okay. Yeah. So in your report, I don't want to simplify it because I know that you are a scientist, but is it basically saying that those casings came from this particular gun?
My exact wording would be very similar to that. It would say items, whatever the unique identifier is, were identified as having been fired from item, which is the gun.
Okay. So. This particular gun, correct?
Correct.
And then you would say that those projectiles also came from this particular gun. Is that correct? Okay. And then... And this testing was done this year on March 4th, is that correct?
March 4th is my report date, meaning all of the analysis is completed and it is done at that point. My analysis was actually conducted on the 3rd.
Okay. Okay, no more questions. Thank you.
Redirect.
Which side did the casings eject from on this Springfield?
On this particular Springfield, the ejection port is angled to the right and up.
Okay. Let me ask you this. When casings are ejected and you're not attempting to move your arm or the gun, do they always land right in the exact same spot?
They do not.
Do they bounce and roll?
They do. Again, it's a very violent action. That slide is moving very quickly. A lot of times the cartridge case is spitting, so they could tumble through the air and again bounce off of anything such as the floor, walls, anything around.
So even as each time you pull the trigger, if you're trying your hardest to keep it as still as you can, does that mean the casings will land exactly right next to each other?
No, they won't.
Where the casings land, does that depend on multiple factors?
Absolutely.
So the type of flooring or ground would be one thing?
Any kind of intervening objects, type of flooring, if it lands on grass, it's probably going to stick or stop, or if it lands in carpet or tile, wood, all bounces differently.
If it bounces off a wall, that would impact where it might land?
Yes.
So having fired guns multiple times, semi-automatics, at your best in trying to keep them together, are they maybe grouped in a general area together?
Typically, when we're firing multiple rounds repeatedly, they tend to generally land in like kind of a pool area. It's not small, but it is a generalized area.
And in a situation where a gun may be slightly moved, that cantering of a gun, can that change the location of the casing itself?
Absolutely. I mean, it's designed as it's designed. It will eject up and to the right. So, I mean, if you turn it this way, it's up. Could change dramatically, however you're angling it or turning it.
When you are talking about casings and where they land, even if you go and see them, are you able to look at them and say that was from shot number one or that was from shot number two?
Oh no, we just generalize an area of where a shooter might have been.
And again, that's just because they're landing at best in a pool area, even if you're trying to shoot as straight in the uniform as you can.
That's correct.
I have no other questions, Your Honor.
All right. Any questions for this witness from any member of the jury? I see at least one coming down.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.